You may be seated. All right, good afternoon, everyone. I'm sorry, Judge Tao had an unavoidable incident he had to get to, so he will be reviewing this by videotape. I wanted to assure you he will be watching this. So in any event, we're ready on the record on, let me see if I say this right, Cezeda versus State, case number 71731. And I would just ask both the state and the defense to make sure for my clerks to state your names for the record. And I would ask the appellant whether or not they would like rebuttal time and how much rebuttal time would you like?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, that would be the order. All right, so whenever you're ready to proceed, come on up and approach.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Tyler Gaston from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of Syed Zadi. May I please report?
Yes.
I'll start with the first issue that we brought up. Specifically, the district court abused its discretion in denying the two forced cause challenges that we made at trial, specifically against Karen Shuey Ridges and Lisa Rich. Under Weber and Blake, we see that the analysis we go through on these kind of inquiries is A, did the district court abuse its discretion in denying a four-cause challenge? And B, did that result in actual prejudice to Syed Zadi? And in this case, both of those happened. Karen Shuey Ridges could not be fair and impartial. She's been a victim of exactly the same kind of crimes, identity theft, stolen credit cards, as the victim in this case. And when the court questioned her about her, was there anything about those experiences that would affect her ability to be fair and impartial, she said possibly. When I questioned her later, she indicated, as pointed out in our reply in our main brief, she indicated several times that there's a possibility she could be biased, maybe. And even upon further questioning by the state and the court, maybe she wasn't as verbal about the possible bias, but she still was never unequivocal.
Let me ask you this. It was interesting when reading this that you originally moved to strike like four jurors. Then the district court didn't rule on it and allows a traverse of the four. And then you only renewed your objection as to two.
Yes, ma'am.
And then ultimately used your peremptory challenges on those two.
Yes, ma'am.
So what, I mean, you know, you didn't say on this, I renew it as to all four.
Correct. And the way I viewed it and the way I think this court should view it is, I guess, two parts. A, we initially made a four-cause challenge on all of these juries. Thus, we objected that they were not fair and impartial, thus preserving the issue. Now, ultimately, the court didn't make...
Didn't renew that objection because that judge, you know, what happens is the judge didn't rule on it.
Correct.
Okay, so you did object. But then the judge doesn't rule on it and allows more questioning. Then when you're asked to renew your objection or do you have challenges for cause, you only say two. Because what if, in the big scheme of things, hypothetically say, I agree with you, and then you have Presadio that says that if you end up using your peremptory challenges and they're not put on the jury, you've got a fair and impartial jury. You only challenge two jurors after that.
I viewed the renewal as there was a new basis based on the new question. There was the initial four-cause challenge.
Right.
They indicated they couldn't be fair based on them being victims of these crimes, similar types of crimes. And then Shuey Ridges and Rich even go further on the further questioning, start talking about how the defendant's going to testify, they're going to hold it against them, and so forth, and we renewed our challenge based on the new information. But even if the court views us as having essentially not preserving the
fair. I mean, the court asked you, do you have any challenges? It didn't rule on four. Do you have new ones? You only had two.
Fair enough. And I don't think that changes the result of this appeal. I think the appeal is still meritorious. Because, and yes, I get the sense of Presciato. There's two analyses. Was there an abuse of discretion on denying a four-cause challenge?
But they didn't rule.
Well, so we're not challenging Town and Bridgewater as the abuse of discretion.
Okay.
In this case, it's Shuey Ridges and Rich. That's an abuse of discretion. If the court agrees, we get to see actual prejudice. In cases like Presciato, you see that there's no actual prejudice because the juror ultimately didn't make it onto the jury, like Shuey Ridges and Rich, because they didn't make it onto the jury. Mm-hmm. And Weber even says that the constitutional significance of a fair jury is limited to the jury that's actually seated. So there's a two-part. A, abuse of discretion to deny a four-cause challenge on Shuey Ridges and Rich, and then we look at the jury that was actually impaneled to see if they were biased, and Town and Bridgewater was biased. And if you look in Blake, and this is the state's own case, if you look at Blake, they talk about the part then, the analysis. It's And I'll put the exact site here because I want to talk about this to the court. In Blake v. State of Nevada, the Supreme Court says, although Blake exhausted his peremptory challenges, he does not argue that any juror actually in him was unfair or biased. Therefore, even if the district court improperly denied his challenge for cause, because Blake exercised the peremptory challenges to remove the veneer member, and because he has not shown that any juror actually impaneled was unfair or biased, we conclude he can't demonstrate any error. There's a two-part analysis. They didn't just say, even if we agree, the juror didn't make it on. End analysis. They go further to say, and he can't show any juror actually impaneled was not fair or biased. So it's a two-part analysis. Was there error, and was it abuse of discretion denying our for-cause challenge against Shue, Ridges, and Rich, which it was? And then B, was any juror actually impaneled?
The judge didn't rule on the first one.
At Shue, Ridges, and Rich, he did. He denied those. And that's the abuse of discretion. He didn't. It doesn't matter for purposes of this appeal whether he ultimately made a decision on Towner or Bridgewater, just like in Blake. Because then we go further, and then we look at the jury, was any of the ones actually impaneled and unfair? And they were. Towner and Bridgewater was. So because we had to exercise our peremptories on Shue, Ridges, and Rich, we didn't have peremptories to get rid of Towner and Bridgewater. So the jury that was actually impaneled is biased. So it's not, when we're looking at the jury that was actually impaneled to see if they're biased, it's not limited to only the jurors that we challenged for cause. Because if it were, then in Blake, the Supreme Court would just have stopped their sentence. And specifically, it's on page 12 of the printout, but it's on page 578 of the actual case. On the top of the second page, they go through the analysis, and they go further. It's not just because the people he challenged for a cause didn't make it onto the jury, there's no constitutional concern. There's that one extra step, and because he couldn't show anybody that actually did was biased. And in this case, I can show that the people who actually made it on the jury was biased. Towner and Bridgewater, by their questions, they were biased, were not fair, and I did not have any peremptories left to strike them. And so I can show both, that Shue, Ridges, and Rich were unfair and should have been stricken for good cause, and then shifting to the question of actual prejudice, we look at the 12 members of the jury that were actually seated, and were any of them actually unfair, and they were.
Towner and Bridgewater. Did you renew your challenge on Towner and Bridgewater?
I didn't, and I don't think I have to, and that's kind of my talk.
What's the case that says you don't have to, when the court asks you make your challenges, that you don't have to re-challenge?
I would say Blake v. Nevada. And it's not, the court's right. If I didn't renew my challenge to Towner and Bridgewater, and I was standing here before you saying that it's abuse of discretion to deny my for-cause challenge, you'd look at me silly and say, where's the for-cause challenge?
Right.
And that's not what I'm saying, because I think that would be appropriate. Instead, I don't have to make a for-cause challenge. Blake v. State of Nevada stands for the proposition, or will in this case at least, stands for the proposition that I don't have to make a for-cause challenge when we're talking about the actual prejudice. I did make a for-cause challenge to two jurors. It's Shue, Ridges, and Rich. If the court agrees...
I have to reread Blake.
And it's the site is the 578, but assuming the court agrees with me, sake of argument, that Shue, Ridges, and Rich were an abuse of discretion, I'm not precluded from showing actual prejudice, which is the second part I have to meet, simply because the two jurors I'm saying are prejudiced, I didn't challenge for cause. And that's what Blake would stand for. Because if that was what the Supreme Court thinks, they would have stopped that sentence after, because Blake exercised a peremptory challenge to remove the veneer, therefore, the veneer didn't get on, they would just stop if that's what they thought the law was. Instead, they go one step further, and they say, and he can't show anybody that actually made it on was biased, implying that he could have, even though that veneer member didn't make it on the jury, he could have pointed to other members of the veneer that did, that were biased, even though he didn't challenge them for cause. So my not challenging Towner and Bridgewater for cause doesn't preclude the court from finding actual prejudice because they made it onto the jury. Now, ultimately, the court still will have to find that the court abused its discretion in denying the for-cause challenge of Shue, Ridges, and Rich to get there. But I think they do. I think I've met that. And I kind of cited, I pointed out that, Ms. Westbrook pointed all that out in the briefs. And Weber points to that, too. And I think of note is nowhere in the state's opposition did they point out any argument that we somehow waived this issue by failure.
I looked at it. I went right through it, and I said, did they renew that challenge?
And I think the court can affirm or reverse on, you know, whatever reason it finds it to be. Just because the state didn't raise it doesn't preclude you from finding it. But I do think it's somewhat persuasive that the state didn't raise this issue at all, and in fact conceded in their fast-track opposition, conceded that all the issues were preserved. And there's no cases cited to by the state The state, there's no case cited to that contradicts what I'm saying. I'm willing to admit that this might somewhat...
Well, I'll ask the state when they get up about Blake and to distinguish it, so that will be interesting.
And to clarify, Blake is the case that the state cited in their opposition.
Right.
That supports my point here. But just because this might be somewhat of a novel approach to showing prejudice doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean I'm wrong. Just because it's new and doesn't happen often doesn't mean I'm not right. And there's no case saying I can't do this, that we can't do this. And in fact, if you look at Battle, if you look at Weber, Blake and Weber, and we also think about policy-wise, it makes sense that this is the way we would do it. Because otherwise, the rules would be different in these cases. It would be simpler.
So you're saying you don't waive it if, in fact, you don't renew the motion, that the one time, even though the judge didn't rule on it, it says, clarify your motion.
Somehow
you didn't waive it.
I might very well have waived any for-cause challenge to Town of Bridgewater. That's true. Mm-hmm. But I didn't waive using them as an example to show bias. Let's say juror number 11, I don't know whatever that name was, juror number 11 was biased for some reason. Even though I never challenged that juror for cause, I can still use that to show actual prejudice, assuming I have some for-cause challenge that was an abuse of discretion to deny. Just because they denied my for-cause challenge erroneously, then we look at the jury and panel to see if they're unfair, all 12. Doesn't matter if I challenged them for-cause or not. I still have to have challenged somebody for-cause to give basis for an appeal. And so I couldn't use Town and Bridgewater as my issue here, issue one, prong one, the erroneous denial of my for-cause challenge, because there was no for-cause challenge there. But I can look at anybody on the jury to show actual prejudice when I can successfully argue that they abused discretion for a for-cause challenge of somebody else. And in this case, that's what happened. They abused, she, Bridges, and Rich were not fair. They made it on to the jury, or even though they didn't make it onto the jury, the question is, can I show actual prejudice? Somebody that was actually impaneled, not being fair, and in this case, Town and Bridgewater was. And that's different than making a for-cause challenge against Town and Bridgewater. Their bias and prejudice supports the idea that there's prejudice from the denial of my for-cause challenge against Shoe, Bridges, and Rich. If the court has more questions, I'll show answer. If
sorry
not,
about giving you the one issue.
No, I suspect that would be
thank you.
An issue. If I can move on to the second
issue. Well, you've only got 5 minutes. I'll give you 5 on rebuttal.
Oh, is this my rebuttal?
Yeah.
Oh,
I'll give you 5 because I asked the question.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the state, and maybe you could even start off with distinguishing Blake.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Jones, and I am a Chief Deputy District Attorney in the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I am here for the respondent of the state of Nevada. I actually would like to start with the challenge for cause issue. The defense spent virtually all of, virtually all of his time arguing. I see it the exact same way that Your Honor sees it. When defense did initially object to jurors Town and Bridgewater, along with, I believe there were 5 or 6 others, Judge Kephart thought that those requests were a bit premature. And so he said that both parties should be allowed to have more questioning. Now, defense, in the state's position, agreed with that approach. When you look on page 421 of Appendix 3, Mr. Gasson says, I'll just wait until after the questioning to make a record on that for-cause challenge, if there's still, and then he trails off. But he does say that the approach proffered by Judge Kephart, quote, made sense. Now, when we go to the end of the voir dire, on pages 502 and 503, they only were new with respect to shooting Bridges and Rich, which leads me to believe that they thought that both Town and Bridgewater met the for-cause standard. In other words, they could serve as proper jurors. In other words, just like Your Honor said, they did not renew their objection with respect to those two jurors because it wasn't meritorious at the time.
Let me ask you, moving on to the juror that ultimately stated that she was a victim, and I have her as juror 29. She's a victim of an automobile burglary. She's a victim of credit card fraud. The whole thing makes her angry, and it would affect her impartiality. Later, she does a traverse, and I can be fair and impartial, okay? Now, you've had this done, so I'm saying a bright line rule, and I wrote an opinion on this in a civil case. What if a juror says, you know what, I've been wrongly arrested by the police, I hate the district attorney's office, They prosecuted me wrong. And, you know, this makes me angry. And then Traverse comes around and they go, but I can be fair and impartial. Why are the words, but I can be fair and impartial? Isn't there an implied bias going on here? This is exactly the kind of juror that should not be on this jury. The exact same thing happened to her. She may be great for a murder case. She may be great for a medical malpractice case. Isn't this exactly the kind of juror that should not be on? Why would the state sit there and dig their heels in to get this person on the jury and then sit here and tell us that this person doesn't have an implied bias? Like, I don't get it. And by the way, the rule would go the same for them, too. If you have a rule of implied bias, a rule is across the board. Why, because somebody sits there and looks at, well, what are they going to say to the judge? I can be fair and impartial.
In other words, if
you look at the totality.
If the jury reveals facts that suggest a bias, is the mere statement, I can be fair, I can probably be fair, enough to rehabilitate, or has the... have the facts been shown that that person shouldn't serve on the jury? So that gets us into the argument that was just made by Mr. Gaston, that, hey, we already showed this person had a bias. Two of these people ended up on the jury. Even though we didn't renew the challenge, we already showed.
You got structural error going on, right? With Batson, you got structural error and you got for cause challenges, and you're going to dig your heels to get this person on your jury.
Well, substantial impairment.
I'm baffled by it.
Well, substantial impairment doesn't reach a perspective of jurors' preconceived views on questions. So, in this instance, I understand why people would be upset by credit card fraud. And if we started kicking jurors in credit card cases who've experienced credit card fraud, then we're not going to be able to get a jury.
I didn't say credit card. She had both an automobile. I agree on credit card. Almost everybody's had fraud. You can't find a juror that they're. I tend to agree with you, but this is somebody who is identical to your victim. And our Supreme Court, Justice Stiglitz, just wrote a beautiful decision on somebody who didn't tell anybody that they too were a victim of sexual assault. And as a result, our Supreme Court says that's juror misconduct, right? She didn't tell anyone, she didn't think he was smart enough. And then it's reversed. Why? Because she's in exactly the same situation of the victim of the state. And here you have the same thing going on here. Is that not looking at the whole record of totality, if you look at it, of implied bias? Even if they mimic the little words, I can be fair and impartial. How do you not look at this record and say, this juror should have been kicked?
And which, did you say this was juror 29?
29.
Because 29 I shows Lisa Rich, who ultimately was struck by defense. So she was actually, a peremptory challenge was used by defense on
right.
Lisa
I guess
Rich.
I'm talking about it for cause, because if she should have been kicked for cause, then that can be problematic too if I go back and start reading the Blake case.
Well, not necessarily, because again, because I would argue that no unfairly impaneled jurors made it onto the jury. So in other words, there is no reversible error because there wasn't an unfairly impaneled jury.
Okay, so you're fine. That's fine. I get you with Preciado. Let's go back. Are you conceding then the judge should have, based on my quote argument to you? Like, I read this and I don't understand why the judge wouldn't just kick for cause.
No, with respect to Lisa Rich, I mean, she said numerous times when we asked her, and this is, and the fraud was an out of her, yes, and how did that experience affect you? I have no problems with the criminal justice system, Ms. Rich replied. Personally, it makes you angry, which, as an aside, I think it would make anybody angry, but who wouldn't be?
And she's in an identical situation to the victim in this case, and the judge denied the challenge for cause. So they had to use their peremptory challenge, which they could have used on somebody else. So my question is, basically, now that you're the appellate attorney on this, is this not an implied bias that should have been kicked for cause?
I would argue that she was not equivocal when she said, I believe so. Like when she was saying, can you believe be impartial? She said, I believe so. And when Judge Capcart was there to determine whether or not he believed that statement, he in fact said that he did. And so we have at least two statements by Ms. Rich, that's juror, again, number 29, who says that she can be fair and impartial. And Judge Capcart was in the was the judge sitting there. And I'll point out that on appeal, if the prospective juror's responses are equivocal, capable of multiple inferences, or conflicting, The trial court's determination of the juror's state of mind is binding. That's Walker v. State, 113 of Nevada, 853. So I understand that Chief Judge Serber, where you're coming from. I think what I would argue is that Judge Kephart was in a position to weigh all of the answers that this juror gave and ultimately decided that she could be fair and impartial. And because of that, it's not an abuse of discretion. If I may, I do want to move to the fair cross-section argument that defense makes. I believe it's the second argument in their brief. And I want to make a few points about this.
And ask you first, is this now the new argument that's being made in all the briefs?
I think it's one we're seeing on an increasingly regular basis, yes. And I wouldn't.
And has anything happened to flesh this out in the lower courts to see if there is any systematic exclusion?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We have had instances where judges have allowed the jury commissioner to come in and testify. But as you'll see, and defense acknowledges on the record here that that no court in Clark County has made a finding with respect to there being a systematic exclusion of any distinctive group in Clark County. But I want to make a few other points. Defendant must show that an underrepresentation of any distinctive group that is inherent in the selection process. In other words, there is a systematic exclusion in the jury selection process. And I want to point out in a footnote of Buchanan v. State, that's footnote 4, and Buchanan is cited in the appellant's reply brief. It's according to a Supreme Court case, that being Burke Hewis, and I apologize if I am pronouncing the name wrong, but it says no clearly established precedent of this court supports Smith's claim that he can make out a prima facie case merely by pointing to a host of factors that individually or in combination might contribute to a group's underrepresentation. In other words, they must show that underrepresentation is inherent in the particular selection process. And what we have here is on page 428 of Appendix 3, Judge Kephart specifically asks appellant, make a record as to why you believe in this particular case minorities are being excluded. And the appellant's response was basically that, look at who's in the courtroom. Further, prior to that, he had mentioned DMV records and utility records, but it was just pointing to a host of factors without any actual evidence or proof. Further, other groups, as the record showed, were overrepresented on our panel. We had, I believe, I found six distinct groups who were present on that panel, some of which were overrepresented and others were underrepresented. So because of that, because of the fact that defense didn't cite any particular reason why there's underrepresentation in Clark County's jury selection pool, he denied the motion. The final point I want to make with respect to this is that the appellant knew going into court that this was an issue that he was going to raise. In fact, when Judge Kephart asked defendant, he basically concedes on 439 of Appendix 3, he believed well ahead of trial that Clark County was systematically excluding folks from the jury pool. Because this was not an issue that defendant was surprised with, he should have filed a pretrial motion. And this is one of the reasons why Judge Kephart denied this particular request from defense. Motion, and one of the things that defense said was, well, look, I have two other prongs that I'm going, that I have to meet prior to the third systematic exclusion prong. And my argument is this, and I think Judge Kephart would agree, is that motions are often filed with if-then situations when you respect a trial. Judge, if this happens, then I would like this to happen. And Judge Kephart was basically saying that's what should have happened in this case.
Let me ask you about the photograph of the defendant in custody as he's leaning up against a police car in handcuffs. What would be the relevance at all of putting that photograph in? Where is that relevant?
What I would argue, first of all, I want to point out that the handcuffs were not shown in that photo.
But he's up against a car, hands behind his back at the scene.
The hands are to his, the back of his side is how I would describe it.
This isn't a robbery case. This is an identification case. Certainly, the security guard can take the stand, and you can, as the state, say, is this the guy you saw on that day? I mean, there was nothing in the record about his appearance changing, so why would you put a photograph up of him up against a police car, arms behind the back?
It shows why the security guard would have stopped him in the first place. When you look at that photo...
Is he sketchy looking? Is that it?
Not sketchy. He's slight, and the shirt was tied against his body. And what security officer Newton said is, I could tell by the big bulge in the front of his chest that he had something under there, and I wanted to stop and investigate that. So when we're talking about...
He can say that without putting in a photograph of him, which depicts him, what appears to be in custody, against the presumption of innocence, which on a weighing scale of prejudice versus probative, it ain't that probative, is what you're telling me.
No, I'm telling you that from the state's position, it was probative, because it helps show why the security guard Newton made contact with the defendant.
Well, he's a security guard. He's stopping people. But when he looks sketchy.
As a state, we always want to show that our witnesses are acting reasonably.
So you're going to put in a super prejudicial thing in front of your jury and just push it over the prejudicial edge for error?
Well, it's the state's position that this wasn't prejudicial, and I point out that the admission of photographs are within the sound discretion of a trial court, and it's an abuse of discretion. And there was nothing about this that would inflame a jury to the point of that they must instantly find him guilty simply because he was standing in front of a car with no handcuffs shown. Further, there was testimony the defendant was in custody. So the fact of that testimony coupled with this photo, again, there's no prejudice there with respect to this photo. He had a purse hidden under his shirt, and it's obvious when you look at this picture and you see defendant's slight frame on the date in question why the security guard would have acted the way he did.
On something different, how was the defendant convicted for the expired credit cards?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when you look at the death, and I want to point out that defense did not raise specifically that because they were expired, the defendant should have been found not guilty simply based on that fact. That is not the defense's argument, appellant's argument, I apologize for that, in their opening brief. But what I will say is that when you look at the definition of credit card, it includes, without limitation, the number or other identifying physical or electronic description of a debit card. That includes the count numbers, even on expired cards. And that's why it's the state's position that that wasn't challenged, is because those numbers were still on the card, that's clearly in the record, and the fact that the defendant possessed those means that he possessed a debit card pursuant to the definition and statute. What they did with respect to the expired cards is say there was no evidence of intent because they were expired. And it's the state's position that the jury could have gotten to an intent in numerous ways. They could have, the fact that the appellant held on to these expired cards is pertinent evidence. Or when confronted by Newton, his flight, or the sorting of the cards, or finally the presumption. So with that, Your Honors, thank you.
Thank you so much for your argument. Okay, we'll hear from the
appellant
for 5 minutes.
And Mr. Court, the issue that Judge Silver was pointing out with respect to Juror Rich applies with even more force to Juror Bridgewater, who actually made it onto the jury. When we're talking about the actual prejudice problem, yeah, it's abuse of discretion. Judge Cathcart should have gotten rid of Rich and Shuey Bridges, so we could have gotten rid of Bridgewater. But with respect to the actual prejudice, Bridgewater actually had her credit card compromised briefly, and we're going to talk about comparisons. Her purse was stolen out of her car, exactly the information that was introduced in this case, where we argued that shouldn't come in the first place, and the judge found it was res geste because you just can't talk about the facts of this case without bringing up the purse was stolen, which is also part of our allegation of error. So the judge, with respect to Your Honor's point, the juror that actually made it on Bridgewater is even more prejudicial than Rich because her prior crime is even more similar to the one, and she's also indicating that she possibly can't be fair. And it's not just everyone who's been convicted of a crime that's similar. There's something a little more egregious when someone's indicating that and indicating how they might not be fair because of it, as they're never equivocal at all, similar to the situation in Weber, where the jury could never, as the court says, state without reservation that they can be fair and impartial. And if I can return to a couple points that were made with respect to the evidentiary hearing. In Buchanan, to meet prong 3 of systematic exclusion, they keep talking about how we don't have any proof. we can't show proof if we don't get an evidentiary hearing to show the proof. And Judge Gibbons, you asked a point about what has changed in the last 3 years with respect to this issue. Well, what has changed is we've learned that the jury commissioner sends out summonses equally per zip code. We use the Senate method of getting our jury pool. That would show why all the poor people live in two zip codes and we're getting racial disparities.
That's surprising because I've had evidentiary hearings. In fact, I had one on a Batson issue, brought the commissioner in, still got reversed on structural error by the Supreme Court.
That was last year.
It used to be utilities.
Correct.
So now it's changed is what you're saying.
They use utility bills, they use DMV records, and they use voting records to get the entire jury pool. But the issue, just because you're on the jury pool, it doesn't do you any good if the way you're sending out the summons is part of the problem. So we could have shown, had we had an evidentiary hearing, that she sends out an equal number of zip codes to each zip code. Let's say you're getting 100 jurors, she'll send out 10 summonses per zip code to 10 zip codes. That doesn't do you any good when 30% of the population might be in three zip codes. These are the kind of evidentiary discussions we could have had.
Said there should have been a motion filed before trial, an if-then motion.
It would be very hard to, first, I don't know I'm going to make this motion unless there's actually racial disparity. Just because I'm prepared doesn't mean I should have done it in advance. But let's assume I tried to do it in advance. It would be very tough to imagine a district court judge that's going to grant my request for an evidentiary hearing on a motion I'm not making and don't have a valid basis to make.
We make contingency evidentiary rulings as district court judges all the time.
It's possible. It could have happened. That is correct.
It would be possible for, what would be nice is anybody to file a pretrial, any motion in district court.
If we're talking about best practice, maybe that is what should have happened.
From both sides.
The failure to do that doesn't preclude appellate review and doesn't change the fact that it is an abuse of discretion that denied me the opportunity of that evidentiary hearing. And Williams v. State, that he didn't get an evidentiary hearing, but he didn't request one, and he didn't allege it was because of systematic exclusion. He just said there's no black people on my jury, and that's not fair. And then he tried to argue he should have gotten an evidentiary hearing up here. That's different. I requested an evidentiary hearing. I specifically explained why I wanted one, and then I tried my best to make the offer of proof without one. But the whole not having proof to show the issue, I can't present evidence if I don't have an evidentiary hearing. And it's not just you get an evidentiary hearing every time you raise the issue. I still have to meet prong one and prong two. We're not opening the door to a ton of evidentiary hearings. And this doesn't necessarily overrule Battle, where they relied on the transcript from another case. You don't even have to go that far. And with respect to the final 2 points, just sort of brought up the issue with the photograph. One thing that's pretty important is that the state, when Judge Kepler ordered that this could come in, the state was representing that they would use it a little bit in the cross-examination of the security guard. That's not what happened. That record was made. They used it in their opening. They used it with the security guard. They paraded around in closing.
How'd they use it in opening if it wasn't admitted in evidence until middle of trial?
I could be misremembered, in fact, about the opening. I thought they used an opening because it was prospectively admitted. I could be wrong. Maybe it was just with respect to the cross the security guard and the closing arguments on the slides. But I did make a record at the end of the trial about how they used this photograph far more than they initially indicated to the court, because they used it for exactly the reason that they're not allowed to.
Did they use it in a PowerPoint at closing,
yes,
too?
Yes, they did. And I made a record at the end of trial, and that was part of the issue. They paraded it around to deprive Saizada of his right, of his indicia of innocence. And with respect to the credit cards, state saying their view as to why the court denied my motion for judgment of acquittal, that's not what the court said. The court specifically said he's going to deny my motion for judgment of acquittal because the jury could make a fair inference that he must have stolen the purse because of the time difference between stealing the purse and him being found with the purse. That's exactly the kind of prohibited inference you're not allowed to make from a bad act. And the judge himself made that. So the idea that the jury wouldn't have made that unfair inference, especially when Bridgewater was impaneled, who had been a victim of the same kind of crime, it is somewhat absurd. So I'm asking the court to give us a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both so much for your arguments here today. This matter will stand submitted.